This is a National Museum of Australia recording. For more information, visit nma.gov.au/audio.
Good afternoon and welcome to the National Museum of Australia. My name is Lily Withicom. I'd like to begin by acknowledging the Ngunnawal, the Noongar and the Ngambri traditional owners of the land on which we meet and to pay respect to their elders, both past and present. So welcome to our History of the World in 100 Objects lecture series. So far we've hosted lectures exploring big history, dawn and diaspora, and the cradles of civilization. And today we're moving on to the rise of the empires. So we're fortunate to have two wonderful speakers with us here today. They're both academics and curators, and they're working with some of the most significant collections of classical objects here in Australia. So Elizabeth Minchin is now Emeritus Professor of Classics at the ANU, where she has taught ancient Greek and Latin language and literature and ancient history, teaching courses that pull together material culture and ancient texts of all kinds in an attempt to recover aspects of everyday life in the ancient Greco-Roman world. Elizabeth is interested in the workings of memory. She's written on the role of memory in the composition of the Homeric epics and on the role of features of the landscape in prompting memory for stories of all kind. Elizabeth is also the curator of the ANU Classics Museum. And this is an unpaid endorsement. She didn't ask me to say this. But if you haven't visited this museum yet, I really strongly recommend that you do. It's a beautifully laid out space. It has a beautiful array of objects. And it even has a collection app. The ANU Classics Museum has also a thriving friends community and a vibrant lecture series. So if you enjoy this, I really recommend you look this up and attend some of the lectures. We also have Paul Donnelly here today speaking with us. He's now the Associate Director at Sydney University Museums, where the three main collections, including the Maclay Collection, the Nicholson Museum, and the Sydney University Art Gallery, are going to be merged into a new purpose-built site. The Nicholson Museum is the largest collection of antiquities in the Southern Hemisphere. It's a remarkable resource as a teaching collection for school students as well as undergraduate and postgraduate students, and has had some really interesting exhibitions over the last decade. Many of you will probably remember the Lego Pompeii. And I really look forward to hearing about the new space. I'm sure we all do. Prior to working at Sydney University Museums, Paul worked at the Powerhouse Museum for more than 20 years. His PhD from the University of Sydney was on the ceramics of ancient Jordan, and he remains active in archaeological excavations in both Jordan and Greece. So the three of us are going to endeavour to give just 20-minute presentations today. I have a feeling we're actually going to run over time, so rather than finishing at 3 o'clock, we may well extend to about 3:30. If you need to leave, you can just exit by the same door you entered, but I think you'll probably be spellbound and you won't even notice the passing of time. Okay, so I'm going to give the first talk and then Elizabeth and then Paul. Okay, so now I have to introduce myself. So I finished my PhD in London 3 years ago on the religious architecture of Augustine and early imperial Rome. Over the last decade, I've worked on a number of Roman excavations throughout Italy as well as the Middle East. And for my PhD, I focused on two sites in central Rome, the Capitoline and the Palatine Hills, and I reconstructed the various Augustan-era buildings, particularly temples, on these two major sites. And I've always been drawn to the Augustan period. It probably started as a child with Asterix comics. And as I grew older and learnt more about it, I became really profoundly fascinated by the Augustan period. This is because it's a time of transition and change, and it brought about radical transformations in the political order of Rome, as well as religion, art, and architecture. These changes did not just affect the Italian peninsula, but they reverberated throughout the Mediterranean and beyond. The Augustan period also signalled a major turning point in the political, social, and cultural life of the Western world. So in the exhibition, A History of the World and 100 Objects, the Augustan period is represented by this head. This is the famous Meroe head of Augustus, and I'm going to be referring to this throughout the talk simply as the head of Augustus. Now, even though the full statue is no longer intact and we only have this head, it's nonetheless a remarkably rare example of a significant and beautifully preserved fragment of colossal bronze statuary and imperial portraiture. So to a Canberra audience, the head of Augustus is likely to be a very familiar image by now, thanks to the National Museum of Australia's pervasive and far-reaching marketing campaign. Augustus has literally been the face of the exhibition in Canberra. And just yesterday I was in the Canberra Centre and I turned a corner and was face-to-face with this image. The head is made of gilded bronze. This was a material that was reserved for the most important and lavish of statuary types. It features remarkable detail, particularly in the eyes. And this is really, for me, what is the most outstanding feature of this head. So the eyes are inlaid, they have glass pupils set in metal rings with calcite irises, and if you look closely enough, you can actually see, remarkably, the remains of bronze eyelashes. So it's very rare to find this kind of detailing that would survive. When you do have examples of bronze statuary, often the eye sockets are hollow. And I think that this feature, the inlaid eyes, are really what makes this object so arresting and so unique. Now, the hairstyle of Augustus here, this is a very specific iconographic motif. So this is reminiscent of Alexander the Great's iconic hairstyle, a Hellenistic decorative trope, and you can see it here on the screen. So we've magnified a coin of Alexander the Great. This is also in the exhibition. And I think putting these two side by side, you really can see the similarities between the depiction of Augustus and Alexander, and this was very deliberate. So this hairstyle is known as anastole, and this was a defining characteristic in the presentation of a Hellenistic monarch, and it was later absorbed into the Julio-Claudian style guide. All of Augustus's imperial descendants featured a similar hairstyle. So if you line up Roman imperial portraiture, and if you see this particular fringe, the parting of the fringe, you'll know that this is likely to be Julio-Claudian or referencing Julio-Claudian, the Julio-Claudian period. So the eyes are averted from a direct stare, and this suggests the distant gaze of a god. The curve of the head indicates that the body of the statue was arranged in the contrapposto style, representing the perfect counterbalance and showcasing the craftsperson's grasp of classical sculptural traditions. Now, we don't know what the rest of the body looked like, but we can probably reconstruct it knowing what we do know about Augustan statuary already. It's likely that in this statue, Augustus stood with one arm outstretched and attired in the garb of an imperator. And I'll explain in a moment why this particular argument can be made, but for now I'm just going to return to the man himself, so the Emperor Augustus. Now, he's the adopted son of Julius Caesar. He comes to power after tumultuous decades in the Mediterranean, when civil war tore apart the political structures of the late Republic. The Roman Republic was a unique political system. It had been governed by aristocrats, and some new men as well, who were elected to public magistracies of fixed terms, often of 1 to 2 years. So the great difference with Augustus is that he takes power as the sole leader without election, and he rules without a break from 27 BC to 14 AD. So it was entirely unprecedented. His rise to power was marked by violence and ruthlessness, but also by good timing, excellent military support, and above all, good luck. Augustus was an unusually fortunate individual, and he explained his good fortune in terms of the Roman gods bestowing a very unique favour upon him. So I think at this point it's important to register the fact that Augustus was the first emperor. So questions of how to represent and how to understand an emperor must have been circulating throughout the Mediterranean. And at the time, these discussions couldn't be resolved. But by the end of his period of rule, Augustus had probably come up with an answer. The official titles for Augustus provide some insight into the ways that he was represented and understood. Literature and inscriptions from the time inform us that Augustus was known by a series of very familiar titles which drew on naming conventions of the Roman Republic. So, for example, Augustus was called Imperator Caesar Augustus. So he's a general and he's the son of Julius Caesar. Pater Patriae, the father of the fatherland, and also Princeps Senatus, the first man of the Senate. But he was actually born as Gaius Octavius, and he was known as such for the first 36 years of his life. It's only in 27 BC, when he's 36 years old, that he chooses the name Augustus. Now, at the time, there was no one else who was called Augustus, and in fact, the selection of the name Augustus was highly unusual. Roman authors tell us that previously it was an adjective that was only ever used to describe the most holy of contexts. So, for example, a site that had been marked out by the augurs, the special priests in Rome, for a major public temple within the city walls, this could be described as Augustus. So it would appear that the name Augustus was chosen because of its very specific, very Roman connotations of divine blessedness. And this was perfectly appropriate for a man who would go on to hold all of the priestly offices in the city, who would sponsor a city-wide program of temple restoration and rebuilding, and who presented himself as not only uniquely favoured by the gods, but as the direct agent of the gods on earth, in particular Jupiter. Now, while the official titles for Augustus were reassuringly reminiscent of the pre-existing political order, the official portraiture of Augustus, of which we have an example here, offers quite a different insight into how he was portrayed throughout the empire. So by the early imperial period, there would have been thousands, perhaps tens of thousands, perhaps even more, of statues of Augustus displayed throughout the empire. And today, around 250 statues of Augustus have survived, predominantly in marble. And while there is certainly some evidence for variation in the earliest portrait types of Augustus, it would appear that representations of Augustus in imperial statuary standardised into a canonical form in the mid-20s BC. And the most well-known type is now is that which is now known as the Prima Porta type. And this is named after a famous marble statue in the Vatican, which you can see here on the left. So the Prima Porta type was the most successful imperial portrait of Augustus in relation to number of surviving copies, geographical and chronological distribution, and stylistic impact on later imperial portraiture. And so, simply in terms of probability, if we were to attempt to reconstruct the body of this statue, it would make the most sense to reconstruct the body of the head of Augustus in this style. And to summarise the Prima Porta style, we have a youthful Augustus who is styled like a god, he's standing like an emperor, and he's dressed like a general. Now, this marked a radical break with the previous portrait types of the Roman Republic. In the late Republic, elites were represented in what we know as the verism style of portraiture, and this is a category type which derives from the Latin word veritas, meaning truth. This was defined by the accentuation of the physical features of old age and a frontal presentation facilitating a direct sightline between the subject and the viewer. So even in the audience, you can see that you can make direct eye contact with this man here on the left, a Republican senator, we don't know his name, whereas you can't make eye contact or direct eye contact with Augustus. So the verism type was designed to convey the strength, the wisdom, and the experience of the individual featured. And I think by placing or juxtaposing these two images here, you can just see how markedly Augustan portraiture signals a break with the earlier traditions. And although this particular head dates to early in the sequence of imperial representation, what's really fascinating is that this was actually how Augustus was represented throughout his entire lifetime. So even when he was in his 70s and he was toothless, this is how he was represented. And moreover, throughout the empire, this is how he was recognised. Augustus himself walking down the street may well not have been recognised by members of the Roman Empire, but everyone would have recognised this image. And in the past, it's been supposed that the emperor himself or elite members of the household were behind the design of imperial representations. So there's this idea that Augustus himself or someone in the household creates an imperial brief and then circulates it, and then they commission marble and bronze workshops to create images exactly as they've stipulated. But today most scholars accept that the creation of imperial prototypes was probably the result of competing sculpture workshops, each of which came up with a style designed to appeal to imperial taste and commissioners. Okay, so now having given you an introduction to Augustus and a brief introduction to early imperial portraiture, I'm going to talk to you about how the head was discovered deep in the Sudan. So you can see here where Rome and the Italian peninsula is. So here we have Italy, here we have Rome, and all the way down here we have Egypt, and this is where the Roman province of Egypt stops. And then this is a map here which shows where Meroe is, all the way down to the very bottom of the map, in fact. So it's extremely far south in North Africa, and it's far beyond the rule of Rome. The head of Augustus was found in Meroe in the Sudan in 1910 by the British archaeologist John Garstang, who was the then Professor of Archaeology at the University of Liverpool. And you can see him lounging casually in the field up here. This is Garstang, looking very smug. And Garstang discovered this head beneath the steps leading to a victory temple in Meroe. Alongside of the head were two pottery vessels containing gold dust and nuggets. And in this image here, you can see a Sudanese worker who apparently has just excavated the head. The head is lying facing the side of the trench here. Now, what I really like about this picture is it also allows you to see just how sandy the soil is. And this would have been really difficult to excavate. So it's not surprising that we don't have perhaps the stratus of baulks, which we would otherwise expect in an archaeological trench. But I think it's probably worth pointing out that the nature of what you can see here is really, it looks like gouging, and the uneven nature of the trench to me suggests treasure hunting more than any scientific practice of stratigraphic excavation. And this is in fact supported if you try and go back to Garstang's field notes. They either don't exist or they're really appallingly written and recorded. Now, the story of how this head of Augustus arrived at the British Museum from the Sudan is certainly a story worth telling. So when the head was discovered, it made international headlines. Initially, it was thought to be a head of Germanicus and then Claudius, and then they worked out it was probably going to be Augustus. Now, the Sudanese authorities only allowed Garstang to export the head and the pottery vessels and the gold, and this is following negotiations with the British authorities in the Sudan and with Garstang himself, on the condition that all of these objects would be sent directly to the British Museum and that plaster copies of the head would be sent back in return. However, Garstang had got into the practice of selling some of his most valuable finds. Now, ostensibly, this was to fund his excavations, but I think in practice it was also to supplement his salary. So what he did, and I should say this actually wasn't abnormal practice at the time, but he formed an excavation committee back in England, in Liverpool, and this comprised a number of individuals. But these individuals weren't just interested in archaeology, they're private collectors in England. And each of these members, they give an annual subscription to the Liverpool Archaeological Institute. And then in thanks, at the end of the season, they're all invited to a special dinner, and Garstang regales them with stories of the excavation. And then at the very end, they're all given a specially wrapped package, and they unwrap this package to find treasures from the excavation. So although Garstang had negotiated with the British and Sudanese authorities and he'd agreed on the direct transfer of the head to the British Museum, it turns out he'd actually floated it on the international market. And when he arrived in London and went to the British Museum, he didn't bring the head with him at all. Instead, he turned up with the news that a Parisian private collector had already offered £500 for the head. And so he asked what the British Museum would offer, and there were some protracted negotiations about this. The British Museum were, of course, really unhappy, and in the end they had to raise £1,050, which was a huge amount at the time, and they had to raise this externally in order to pay Garstang. So that's the story of how the head ended up in the British Museum. But the story of how the head of Augustus ended up separated from its body and deposited in the foundations of a temple of victory in Meroe, I think is equally fascinating. Okay. Okay, so Garstang's discovery was remarkable because the head is made out of bronze. So this is a valuable material which rarely survives in the archaeological record. And it came not only from a bronze statue of an emperor, but it comes from a colossal bronze statue of an emperor. So it's exceedingly rare. So when it originally stood to its full height, the total height of the statue would have been about 2 metres. It probably would have been located on a plinth as well. So you're looking at a statue height of nearly 3 metres. However, in this local temple dedicated to the Kushite victory, this is the last place that Garstang expected to find a head of Augustus. And the discovery was remarkable because of the find spot. So thanks to the rich literary tradition from the period, a narrative survives to let us piece together the fascinating story of how this official portrait of Augustus ended up torn from its body and deposited in a foreign temple beyond the borders of the Roman Empire in Meroe in the Sudan. And I'll just explain here what I've put up on the screen. So this is a structure that Garstang erected around the remains of the temple, which were mud brick walls and also some frescoes. And unfortunately, the frescoes haven't survived to the present day, so we only have the early 20th century photographs, which is why they're not the best quality. And so on this fresco here, it's hard to see, but you can see the remains of someone's feet, and it looks as though someone's sitting on a throne here. And I should say as well, Garstang thought it would add a nice macabre touch that people would like if he put a skull here. That wasn't actually found. Okay. Now, so the story begins with one of the most famous love stories in history, that between Mark Antony and Cleopatra. So Mark Antony was a Roman citizen, and he was a former ally and friend of Augustus, Cleopatra, the Queen of Egypt. The naval battle of Actium took place in 31 BC, in which Augustus defeated the combined forces of Mark Antony and Cleopatra, after which they both committed suicide. Subsequent to this, Egypt was annexed and Roman settlements and forts were constructed throughout the new province. And within these new buildings in the new province, statues were set up celebrating and commemorating the new emperor, Augustus. And so this head of Augustus probably comes from one of these statues. And it has been proposed that the head was stylistically reminiscent of earlier depictions of Alexander the Great, who was also a conqueror of Egypt, as a specific ploy to encourage the citizens of Egypt to recognise the new Roman emperor. So, for example, if they'd erected statues of Augustus in the veristic-style portraiture of a grizzled old man, they probably wouldn't have recognised it. But this was something that was familiar, so this was quite clever. But, of course, North Africa was an ancient land with ancient kingdoms, and the establishment of a new rule in Egypt, so far from the centre of power on the Italian peninsula, was always going to be complicated. Beyond the new Roman border were leaders determined to test the boundaries of this new authority. And one such ruler, her name has been given to us as Candace, she's the one-eyed queen of Meroe. And the Greek historian Strabo records that in 25 BC, Candace and her army raided a number of the newly established Roman settlements and forts in Egypt. She carried back booty with her, apparently all kinds of imperial statuary, which she took back to her kingdom in triumph. So in the case of this head of Augustus, it would appear that Candace brought back the full colossal bronze statue of Augustus to her kingdom, and upon deciding that it was the most valuable statue of all the loot that she had collected, she cut off its head, we don't know what she did with the body, and she deposits the head in the foundations of this new temple that she dedicates to victory. And so that whenever Candace or anyone else is ascending the stairs to this temple to worship victory, they are literally walking over the head of the Roman Empire, of the head of the Roman Emperor. So in sum, the head of the emperor is permanently below the feet of the captors while they worshipped this local god of victory. And what's actually really interesting is that Garstang described a frieze or a fresco that apparently depicted this very scene. And I'm sorry that it's so grainy, but if you see here, there's a series of individuals who all have their arms bound behind their back. They're all kneeling with their heads bowed, and they've all got varying dress very different styles of clothing. But the figure here at the end is perhaps the most interesting, because it looks as though he's actually wearing a Roman tunic. And Garstang described that he also had a helmet, a Roman helmet on his head, and he very confidently identified this as a Roman soldier. And then in an upper register of this fresco, you had a ruler who was seated, larger than the size of these figures here, with his feet on top of these captives. So here we have an iconography of conquest that is also played out physically by depositing the head of Augustus in the Temple of Victory in Meroe. However, this brief skirmish on the edges of the empire was not unnoticed and therefore would not go unpunished. The general Petronius launched a counterattack almost immediately. He soundly defeated Candace and her army, and he fined them with reparations that were so huge that it was only a few years later that Candace and delegation collected the statuary and went directly to Augustus, returned all of the statuary, begged his forgiveness, promised they would never do it again, and begged him to lift the fines because they simply couldn't pay them. And Augustus forgave them immediately. However, the head of Augustus remained where it had been deposited, preserving this particular act of iconoclasm, as well as a rare example of Roman bronze colossal statuary. Portraits of Augustus have been found throughout the empire, consistently representing a youthful general and a god. And it was Augustus who achieved the longest and most prosperous period of rule in Roman imperial history. Now, this head is no exception to this representation. It more or less embodies it. But the Meroe head of Augustus doesn't just tell the story of Augustus in Rome. It tells two parallel stories, that of the victor and that of the vanquished. So when you go back to see this object in the exhibition, if you look closely enough at the surface, you can see fine grains of sand that are still stuck to the surface of the portrait, sands from the kingdom of Kush, which are embedded onto the face of one of the most famous rulers of history.
Well, thank you, Lily. Lily has, as it were, set the scene for opening some windows now onto life in the Roman world, particularly in the Roman Empire, and particularly life amongst the elite. I'm going to talk about three items. First of all, this pepper pot, which is one of my favourite things. It's only 10 centimetres high, 4 inches. You can imagine feeling the weight of the silver and the gold in the palm of your hand. I think it's something that gives me a great deal of delight. Something else that gives me a great deal of delight is the story of its find. Just as Lily talked about the find of the head of Augustus, this pepper pot was found in 1992 by a metal detectorist, apparently that's the term you use, in Suffolk, at a place called Hoxton. It was part of a hoard, a huge hoard. In fact, the largest hoard found within the bounds of the Roman Empire. It contained something like 15,000 coins. It contained items of silver, items of gold, all kinds of precious objects. The form of the pepper pot, as you can see, is a lady of some wealth, obviously. If you look at her garment, it is bordered elaborately with gold, and this is representing the elaborate embroidery that would have been on an original gown. She is also holding a scroll. Notice her; she's fingering delicately this scroll, and the scroll testifies to her level of education. She's an educated lady, of some wealth. She isn't wearing any kind of diadem at first when this little pepper pot, along with three others, I should add, when this pepper pot was discovered, it was first thought that she was an empress, and it's often called the empress pepper pot. But in fact, she's not wearing any kind of diadem coronet, so it's a lady, not an empress. What you can't see here is the underneath side, the base of the pot. This is where there's a most ingenious mechanism. A little rotating disc is on three settings underneath, and you can move it around as you wish. The first setting opens a gap for filling the pepper pot. The second setting gives you a smaller hole for extracting some of the pepper over some food, and the third setting simply closes the hole, so you're not trailing pepper all the time. But so I find this so ingenious and so charming. Now, I've been talking about pepper. Where does pepper come from? Well, once again, Lily's account of Roman history gives us some context. With the conquest of Egypt in 30 BC, trade routes were opened up. Trade routes that Romans hadn't had access to before. Previously, the Mediterranean had been their field. With the conquest of Egypt, they had access to further reaches. In fact, as far as India, the west coast of India, traders were able to obtain pepper. And they brought it back across the Indian Ocean, up the Red Sea, by land, then across the Mediterranean. In fact, pepper was not the only spice that they obtained. There was cardamom, ginger in particular, and cloves. Cloves came with the aid of Arab traders. Cloves came from as far as Indonesia. So spices are moving into the Roman world at the end of the Republic into the Empire. And by the time of the Emperor Vespasian, between 69 and 79 AD, in that period, so only about 100 years after the conquest of Egypt, a spice market was opened in Rome. And in this spice market are not only spices, but all sorts of other precious goods that have come from further afield. So silks, for example, are being traded in that spice market in Rome. Now, spices, having travelled so far, are luxury items, and the pepper that goes with this little pot is a luxury item housed in a luxury item. Romans liked display, and so in a Roman house, the silverware would be on display in the home so that guests who are admitted to the private parts of the house, guests can admire it. I should say, too, that we have evidence of how spices are used in the recipes that have come down to us from the later writer Apicius, who has left a set of recipes. And you find in a number of those the ingredients include spices. And, of course, his recipes are going to be, once again, recipes for the elite. They're not how to make a simple soup. They're how to make something that will impress your guests at dinner. Now, the habits and the tastes of Rome moved to the provinces. They moved to the provinces with the administrators, the governors of provinces and so on, and they moved to the provinces with the army. And I'm thinking particularly of Britain. Britain had been a province since the time of Claudius, the Emperor Claudius. It had to be administered, and there was the presence of the army. So the leading, the higher officers in the army would travel to Britain with their wives, with their families, and they would set up their homes. And the other people in Britain who would have aspired to having items like this were the Britons themselves, those Britons who came in contact with the Roman administration. And they too wanted to take on some of the habits and the customs and the tastes of the Roman world. And this is a process that we call Romanization. So what we have then is an item from a collection of very fine silver. It was manufactured. It was produced about 350 to 400 AD. So it's well after the time of Augustus, but still very much part of the Roman world. But what is interesting is that the moment at which Rome lost Britain as a province is in about 412 AD. So not so long after this was produced. So you've put together the information of the hoard of silver, the end of Roman Britain, and you think this is probably something that has been bundled up with the other pepper pots, with all the coins, with the other items of family, domestic silver. It's been bundled up and hidden in the hope that at some point the owners will be able to come back and retrieve their fine silverware. But, of course, we know they never did. So there's a kind of sad and unfinished tale there. So this little pepper pot, to me, talks about the skills of silversmithing. It talks about the desire for luxury goods. It talks about Romanization. It talks about the desire for tasty foods. It talks about trade patterns. And it talks about the thrill of an archaeological find. A metal detectorist in 1992, we can pretty well all of us remember then. And it's so recent a discovery. So let's move on to our next one. Here. Now, as you can see, this is the sarcophagus, the rather large sarcophagus that's in the collection, in the exhibition, and it was photographed in the exhibition. You can see, very appropriately, the exit sign just above it. This is a sarcophagus produced in about the 3rd century. It was found in Somerset in the UK. And as you can see from the hole drilled in the sarcophagus, it seems to have been used in more recent times as a garden fountain. So it's had another life after its original purpose. Now, this makes us think about the issues of dealing with the dead. The Roman world generally preferred to cremate their dead, but By the first century BC, wealthy Romans, elite Romans, began to think favourably of practices from the Greek East, from the Hellenistic world, where people built elaborate tombs with fine architecture and monumental sculptures. And Romans, elite Romans, began to engage in this practice too. And of course, once you had a tomb, you needed a sarcophagus to go into the tomb. And sarcophaguses were produced in Athens, in Rome, and in a very few other major cities. Generally, and this seems extraordinary to me, they were produced and then transported to their destinations. They were embellished generally embellished either with mythical scenes, with scenes from military life, with scenes from the life of the deceased, so obviously he or she had planned ahead. There are scenes that have Jewish iconography and, like this one, Christian iconography. In fact, there are about 10,000 sarcophagi, I'll get the plural right this time, 10,000 sarcophagi around from the Roman world still available to us. Now, this one, if you've seen it in the exhibition, you'll notice that it is embellished on three sides. We've got the main scene here, which I'll talk about, and the two ends. Each end is also bears some relief carving. The back is plain, and this is because it would have been set into a mausoleum, into a tomb, against a wall. So you didn't need decoration on the back. That would have been wasted. What we have here is the story of Jonah and the whale. So the boat on which Jonah was, and he is on this boat. I don't know which one he is, but one of them. Here's the sea monster that's going to consume him when he's thrown overboard. So that's part one of the story. And I'm not telling you the story because I don't feel I've got enough time for that. And then part two of the story is when he has survived this ordeal and been coughed up again by the whale. He's sitting under a tree, and God has produced this special kind of tree for him, and there's a bit more of the story associated with the tree. Now, why do we think this is Christian? Up here is a lamb, totally unrelated to the scene, but it's a sign. It's a sign to us that this is a Christian burial, a Christian tomb, a Christian scene. By the 3rd century, and as I said, this sarcophagus is a 3rd century sarcophagus, Christianity was certainly well recognised. I mean, Christianity was certainly practised in the Roman world, but it was still a time of persecution. There had been persecutions of Christians since the time of Nero. And it was only a little later than this, by 312, so just at the beginning of the 4th century, that Constantine had his conversion to Christianity. Christianity began slowly to become more and more accepted into this Roman world. But the persecutions, of course, were related to the fact that the emperor, from Augustus onwards, the emperor was considered to be a god, and Christians could not acknowledge the emperor as a god, since they were already acknowledging another god. And so life was very difficult for the Christian community. And indeed, even after Constantine, the following emperor, Julian, apostatized. He went back to paganism, and so for a couple of centuries there was a kind of uneasy movement between pagan observance and Christianity. And our third image is Sophocles. If anyone was here at the panel discussion that Fran Kelly organised, chaired earlier this week, you would have heard her say, "The only thing I don't really get in this exhibition is the bust of Sophocles. What's he doing there?" And she asked whether anyone else of the panel felt like that, but they all wanted to talk about something else. So Sophocles was never really addressed. So here I am to speak for Sophocles. 150 AD, we can date this bust to. It is a Roman copy of a Greek original. Now, this is a phrase that you hear quite a lot when you're looking at sculptures in bronze, marble. that we're looking at Roman versions, let's say, of something that had existed in Greece beforehand. And indeed, our knowledge of Greek sculpture in metal and in marble really is owes such a lot to the fact that Romans copied these Greek originals. Now, from my perspective, what Sophocles speaks to is the cultural debt that Rome owes to Greece. I think that is why he is here. Romans from the Republic, particularly quite conservative Romans, were deeply suspicious of Greek culture. There were various periods at which Greek philosophers were banished from the city when Romans didn't want to have Greek tutors for their children and so on. On the other hand, amongst educated Romans, amongst elite Romans, Greek culture was valued to the extent that Romans employed Greek tutors for their children, to the extent that they learnt Greek, that they studied in Athens, and that they read Greek philosophers, Greek historians, and Greek literature. And in fact, we have, for example, letters from Cicero, who wrote voluminous collections of letters. He was writing to his friend Atticus, who spent a lot of time in Athens, and Cicero was more or less sending him orders for what he might pick up in Athens and send back to him by way of sculpture. And he says, and this will look very nice against an ivy wall. You know, I'll grow some ivy and I'll just put the marble in front of it and it'll set it off nicely. So you could imagine something like this bust of Sophocles set up formally in one of those little courtyard gardens in a Roman villa. Now, it wasn't just sculpture that the Romans borrowed or picked up from Greece. Romans adopted Greek knowledge on metal casting, on coinage, on mosaics, the carving of cameos, perspective drawing and architecture, and more. All these ideas have come from Greece to Rome. But that's not to say that the Romans didn't then do interesting things with these with the skills that they learned. I don't want to bag them for that, but they certainly have a debt to Greece to start with. But that wasn't limited to the fine arts. Their borrowings weren't limited to the fine arts. The Greek forms of literature have shaped Roman literature. So Greek epic is borrowed heavily for Roman epic. We have Greek lyric, Roman lyric. We have Greek novels, Roman novels, Greek historians, Roman historians, and so on. It never stops. It's a huge debt. Let me just say one thing about Sophocles. Sophocles himself, living in the 5th century BC, produced 120 tragedies. He lived till he was 90, and he produced 120 tragedies, which puts most writers to shame, I think, of which 7 entire tragedies have survived to us. That is all we have out of this huge production. The two most famous ones are Oedipus Rex, Oedipus Tyrannus, Oedipus the King, and Antigone, which has been translated into so many languages, of which there have been so many versions. There have been ballets and operas and new translations of this play. And I just want to put in a little plug, because at the end of October, Antigone, the Sydney production of Antigone, is coming to Canberra, and it is getting rave reviews. So have a look in the Canberra Times and check it out. It's just demonstration that culture from the 5th century BC is still alive today. So thank you.
I've got my own little speaker here, which does recall to me many a Madonna video. So if I strike a pose halfway through, you'll understand why. Oh. Okay. Thank you very much, Lily and Elizabeth. We've seen some of the most spectacular items in this show, and it's very heartwarming for a curator to see so many people in an exhibition of this nature and to see it being enjoyed at that level. I have gone for the underdogs of the exhibition, you might say. So I've always been drawn to the smaller items which have big stories to tell. And I'm going to have a little journey today through the Spanish silver dollars and the Kilwa sherds. And I thought I'd use it as an opportunity, and especially in terms of the sherds, to talk about the differences between these kinds of evidence and how you can maximize the kinds of secrets that pottery has. So the Spanish silver dollar, these are the ones in the exhibition. I'm sure most of you have seen the display by now. And the Spanish dollar was produced for many centuries. These look very irregular because they're basically handmade. They're known as cut-off bars. So apocryphally, they were making so much coinage that they would put a wooden rod down into the sand and then pour the molten silver into it, leaving a very rough bar. And then they would cut it off and then make the coin. I think it was actually a little bit more industrialized than that. But it does give the idea of how quickly this kind of currency was being made. And it really was a world currency. And we know them as Spanish dollars. To the Spanish, they were known as eight reales, or royals. And interestingly, if Menzies had his way, we would have been spending royals instead of dollars. There's a nice little connection there. The one at the top has been made by this is about 1619 or so. By this stage, they're making them in, with machinery. They're milling them with powered machinery. But the difference between these two is that coins, and you'll see quite a number of beautiful coins in this exhibition. The wonderful things with coinage is that they, of course, are embedded literally with the stories. They tell you who produced them, why they were produced, where they were produced, often the date in which they were produced. And if you dig down a bit deeper, you'll find out even more secrets. The pottery, on the other hand, it's taken scholars to identify this pottery. The Kilwa sherds were found, discarded, broken sherds, cast up on the beach of a Tanzanian city of ancient Kilwa. They've had to know that they are Chinese, Celadon, Middle Eastern, blue and white, and local pottery. To know that they represent those distant shores, they had to have been studied and had to have been identified. And so in order to see the wonderful stories that make a history of the world in 100 objects, there's often, and as we've discovered today, you can always go deeper. And when it comes to these things, you can't tell. You won't recognize Augustus. You won't recognize where these are. They had to have been identified. Now, it's a bit of a later Spanish dollar. This isn't in the show, but I chose it because it has a more of an Australian connection. You can see it's produced in 1739. We can tell by this M with a zero that it was produced in Mexico. And as the label in the show well attests, the many millions of kilograms of these dollars cost huge numbers of lives, to the point where when they were running out of locals, they had to import African slaves. It was a dreadful business. But it meant that Spain was an absolute superpower. And we've all grown up with the stories and seen the Pirates of the Caribbean and, you know, Jim Hawkins and Pieces of Eight are with his parrot scene and such like. So this is where we get the Pieces of Eight. There's the eight there. As I say, Mexico, plus ultra, further beyond. Spain had great grand aspirations when it came to world power. And here we have the Pillars of Hercules, through which you passed from the Mediterranean into that wide world. And just here's one of the possible origins of our dollar sign here. You can see the ribbon going around that column there. There's a few other candidates, but that's one of the ones that I like. It's, of course, there's an Australian connection there too, because it was a world currency, because there were millions in circulation around the world. When Governor Lachlan Macquarie wanted to have a currency for the fledgling colony of New South Wales, he imported £10,000 worth of, which equated to 40,000 Spanish dollars, and had the centres cut out to make 15 pence, and these remained at their face value of 5 shillings. You can't beat a canny Scot when it comes to making money from money. Incidentally, in terms of the ubiquity of Spanish dollars, the first crime on the first fleet, even before they'd arrived in Sydney, some of the convicts had busied themselves in the hold of one of the ships and somehow had managed to get enough equipment to be able to cast counterfeit versions from shoe buckles of Spanish dollars. And Captain Philip lamented that if only they could use their ingenuity in more legal ways. So these shirts from Tanzania, demonstrating connections across the world, demonstrating that not only do these have show trade across the Indian Ocean, via India, via the Arabian coast, from as far afield as China and Persia. Where you find trade, where you find objects like this, there's also testimony to, of course, the exchange of ideas, religious beliefs, as well as goods. Which is what brings me to my demonstration of how you find out as much as you can from literally the fabric of these kinds of ceramics. And for my sins, I did a PhD many years ago on a particular kind of pottery called chocolate and white. These are examples of them here. I'll go into a little bit more detail, perhaps more detail than you actually want, but I'll try and make it quick, especially since we've technically finished. But so we've got, they're 3,500 years old, and they're found in modern-day Eastern Mediterranean, modern-day Jordan, Palestine and Israel kind of areas. These broken ones are examples of sherds found in living contexts. The complete vessels come from tomb contexts, so they were buried for aspirational life or the afterlife by the dead, as well as being used by the living. But they're relatively rare, and not much was known about them, to the point that they could have been white on chocolate as well as chocolate on white. And I'll wager this is the only chocolate bar that will be shown in this series of lectures. But it's an opportunity to talk about how little was known about this ceramic. Whilst it was very recognisable and various archaeologists across that southern part of the Levant recognised it as being something special, there were a lot of assumptions about this. From other contexts, it was obviously made between about 1550 BC and 1400 BC, which made it, of course, 3,500 years old. But there was never any actual study of the divisions within that, and it started to be abused in terms of when they found chocolate and white, an archaeologist could use it for their own purposes to say this is clearly a Middle Bronze Age deposit. Others could use exactly the same shirt and say this is a Late Bronze Age deposit. So as a student, I figured that this was worthy of further study, and I was lucky enough to be a member of the Pella team, the Sydney University archaeologists in the expedition to Pella, and some of you may have heard Stephen Burke talking recently. He's the director of the excavations. So when it came to, there'd been previous studies of chocolate and white which had said, despite patterns of distribution, that it didn't come from Jordan, that it came from somewhere else, that it was exotic. Others were saying that it was made in Lebanon, even though you didn't find any in Lebanon. So it seemed to me to be a ripe opportunity to try and get as much information with this material as possible, and ultimately join the kinds of objects that we have in the exhibition out there, objects that are able to tell us grander connections and bigger stories. So my study went along there, was multidisciplinary, whereas some scholars had just done, for example, clay analysis, where they'd chosen as many clay samples as they could from around Pella, and then compare it to here, and then find that they weren't the same. They came to the grand conclusion that it wasn't made at Pella. However, that's an assumption that the local clays had all been found. Maybe some of those clays have been buried over the last 3,500 years. Maybe they didn't find the particular level. So there was a lot of assumptions. So I thought, coming from a number of different, converging from a number of different points, you have a better chance of questioning assumptions and finding new results. So I did a distribution across the landscape, which is the simplest thing and involves a bit of travel, which I'll talk about briefly. Ultimately, you find out all the samples you can from and mark out where all the sites they were and see where the hot spots are. The core group, as I say, was Pella, and I was fortunate to be working from a site that had such a large and probably the best group in the whole region. And because of Pella, the Nicholson Museum at the University of Sydney has probably the best collection of this kind of material outside of Jordan. I had to identify and record the samples, which includes drawing and photography. I then did an elemental analysis, which I'll cover very briefly, I promise you, and the quantitative analysis even briefer, and then the conclusions. So just to put it in context, this is Pella here, where I was working from, but it covered this whole site. This is the core area. You've got Cyprus up here, Syria up here, the Hittites up here, the Hurrians up here in terms of empires. The Egyptians are down here. So this area here is squeezed between the superpowers of the era. So in terms of distribution, it's not rocket science. You go around, you count how many samples you can find in publications. Preferably you go and see the items in person, because part of the problem was people were identifying chocolate and white when actually it was just a white slipped ware with a rather fugitive kind of colouring. So I had to decide on making a particular, having a normative kind of group and working out from there. And as you can see, vastly more numbers were from the North Jordan Valley region. So even on this basis, there's a suggestion that Lebanon up here is not the origins of chocolate and white, nor is Egypt and nor is Cyprus. But that's not enough in archaeology. You have to demonstrate your assumptions a bit more scientifically. These are, I thought, an opportunity to show some Pella. This is the tell here with the wonderful, some of you might have been there, the Canaanite temple in here. This is the dig house where we live in palatial splendor, tents. This is a close-up of the temple here. And this is a view from, similar viewpoint from taken up here, but towards the more classical remains. It's a beautiful site, and it was a very important site, situated as it was on main corridors, north-south along the Jordan Rift Valley and east-west through the Carmel Range. So it had close connections to the Mediterranean, as well as to Egypt, and up into Syria and Turkey. So grunt work, of course, includes looking at these sherds. You can, from a simple sherd, you can extrapolate to find vessels of this nature. You had to go to various places in addition to Paris and the British Museum. I went to Toronto, to Harvard, to numerous other places, which was very, very hard work. Sometimes you found celebrity sherds, and here we have this particular one here found by Sir Finders Petrie and published in his Tell the Jewel publication. Here it is drawn here, and I think there's a little bit missing there, so I think they're still trying to find out who did that. Elemental analysis. You can through visualization, through stylistic analysis, you can work out different groups in the fabric, in the style, in the way that the slip has been treated, in the decoration. But it's wonderful to be able to have at our disposal now in archaeology independent, objective means of testing those groups. And so, in a nutshell, elemental analysis, both using synchrotron in Chicago, and that's basically a great big ring of light going around there, off which you have laboratories funneling through to your sherds, and those sherds bounce off the sherds, the light bounces off the sherds, it tells you what kind of elements, whether it's silica or iron or magnesium or whatever there is, and more importantly, it tells you what quantities there are in parts per million, so then you can quantify them and compare them and start to see groups. Here we have Ansto down in Sydney, who did neutron activation analysis, and as I say, synchrotron analysis up in Chicago. Quantitative analysis this represents. I'm not a statistician, but I tell you what, it can do your head in. And this is, I'm not too sure if you're familiar with fly papers, but if you haven't got your head screwed on, you can get caught in the fly paper. That was just to wake you up. So here's some bivariate analysis. This is just one example of many of demonstrating that putting these sherds through objective elemental analysis, quantifying them, you can start to see that the groups that had been identified in terms of fabric independently were observed in the science as well. And that was a really fantastic thing to see that this wasn't just my seeing what I wanted to see. There was a good way of testing that. And that meant that by having different groups, I could do further work, such as this. And so when scholars, as I've mentioned, have been using the same way to show earlier periods and later periods, they might have been finding material like this and saying this is that it's late bronze. Vice versa, they could have been finding material that was equated to in style and use to up here and saying it was made in here. But now with a seriation, these are called battleship curves for obvious reasons, this demonstrates how through time you have a particular type coming in, reaching a period of favoritism and then dying out. And as you can see, there's a gradual sweeping through of the different kinds of fabrics. And so now when an archaeologist finds chocolate and white, if it looks like fabric group one, he can tell by looking at the thesis, he can tell that it actually comes from what particular kind of date it was made in. It makes chocolate and white now a more accurate chronological tool than previously had been the case. In terms of empires, by identifying the different types of sherds, it also meant that we could be more granular in our visibility of the wear. And the red sites here show sites with chocolate and white, and as opposed to white slip and other types of wares which would be confused with this proper wear. And by being able to identify it in a more granular kind of way, more accurately, we were able to see that there was a kind of a pattern. And this is around, as I say, 1550, 1500 BC. When one looked at later Tel el-Amarna texts in Egypt, the names of letters, the names of rulers coming from letters from this region demonstrated that there were sites that had chocolate and white that didn't have Hurrian names. They maintained their original Canaanite indigenous names, which suggested that chocolate and white ware was individual enough and localized enough to be representative as a cultural signifier for a particular group. And when you're between the superpowers of Egypt down here and the Hittites up here and the Hurrians up here, you possibly felt like you wanted to raise the flag on occasion, especially at, say, feastings and on occasions when you wanted to demonstrate your independence. Which brings me back to the Kilwa sherds. So when we see these sherds and we see the fabulous stories represented in the show out there, ultimately, there's a lot of work that goes into these often sweeping statements about what they represent, because unless we study them, unless time is spent identifying the secrets that's within their grains, their stories are always much reduced. So thank you very much.
Thank you so much for those two presentations. They were really fascinating. So if Elizabeth, you can come back up on the stage, and Paul as well. I think we have some time for questions. Thank you for staying over time. And I'd also just like to say thank you very much to Kevin for doing excellent work with setting up the PowerPoint and everything else, and to Janae as well. So thanks very much. All right, over to you all. Questions? Yep. Janae's going to pass around a microphone.
I have a curatorial question. Who actually has the pleasure of being or is allowed to handle the objects in the exhibition?
Oh, okay. Not the National Museum of Australia. So the British Museum, they bring the objects over themselves. They have a special arrangement with couriers and they fly them over. The conservators handle them from the beginning, from when they take them off the plane and they bring them to the National Museum, when they install them in the case and they close them. They close the cases. And we have agreed that we will never open these cases. If something were to happen to an object, if we need to open a case, a conservator is going to have to fly from London to Canberra. But one of the reasons is, for example, the sword in the exhibition, if any of you have seen that beautiful, I think it's a Japanese sword. So the conservator who handles that, she's actually been trained in the arts that this particular sword embodies. So no one else could, perform the appropriate ritual things that go along with this sword as well. So it's not just straightforward object handling sometimes. Often there's, people paying attention very carefully to the rituals that are embodied in some of these objects. So if it was the National Museum exhibition, we would be able to handle it. Our conservators would, under supervision, the curators. But with this British Museum exhibition, just the British Museum.
Thank you. I was just wondering how it was decided among all the many artefacts that have obviously been found in expeditions, etc., how it was decided on these 100 objects, like who decided that they represented the history of the world?
So it was Neil McGregor, the then director of the British Museum, who made the selection. This was his great vision and his great idea. And as you'll know, he actually carried this out in the form of a podcast initially, and then in a paperback. So it's important to know that this was never an exhibition in London. The British Museum never had a history of the world and 100 objects in an exhibition in London. The first time it was shown was in Perth, and it was actually Alec Coles, the director of the museum in Western Australia, who came up with the idea that it could be a travelling exhibition. And I think that, Neil McGregor drew on his favourite objects, from having been the director of the museum for such a long time and all of his experience and knowledge. But I understand that he also took, advice from other departments as well. What's interesting is that if you read the paperback, we actually don't have all of the objects that are listed in the paperback nor in the podcast. So one example is the sensational suffragette penny. I would have loved to have seen that, where someone's written "Votes for Women" on a penny that's sent round in wide circulation. That didn't come out. And the head of Augustus, I initially thought that the head of Augustus had come only to Canberra, but I found out recently Perth had it as well.
We didn't get the Rosetta Stone.
Watch this space. Not for this exhibition, but. One more question. I feel when I said that that there was an unidentified Roman veristic portraiture, I felt that someone gasped. I thought there was an intake of breath and someone was going to tell me that it was identified. No? Okay. right. Well, thank you so much for your patience. I'm really aware that we've run over time. And I hope you enjoyed our session today. And next Sunday, the 13th of October, I understand.
Sorry,
13th of November. That's right. We have another session as well, another lecture series. So if you enjoyed this one, I'm sure you will enjoy that one as well. So thanks very much. Thank you, Elizabeth, and thank you, Paul.
The National Museum of Australia in Canberra explores what it means to be Australian through our permanent galleries, exhibitions, public programs, and the National Historical Collection. Find out more about the museum at nma.gov.au or download more audio programs from nma.gov.au/audio.